So what I want to talk about today are measurements in a two-dimensional Bose-Hubbard system. And what I really want to get across today is a little bit of physics about the 2D Bose-Hubbard system and a whole lot about what we can measure in these systems in general. So I'm going to go into more detail than is usual in these talks about what I actually measure in the laboratory, not this ideal picture that we have momentum distribution and that's that. And I hope for this audience this will be a useful thing because there are frequently computations that may or may not be relevant, and maybe this will lead to perhaps more useful calculations. In any case, I think it'll be interesting for everyone. So the experimental work here has all been done by myself at NIST, and this was done when I was a postdoc, and my postdoc advisor is Trey Porto and Bill Phillips, and now I'm a permanent member of the staff at NIST. And we've been generously funded from a variety of sources. We used to be funded by ARDA, which became DTO. We used to have a NASA grant, and I was funded with the NIST NRC Fellowship Program. So my background is quantum Hall physics, and given that background, it's not surprising I'm interested in two-dimensional systems. So a two-dimensional quantum Hall system is a semiconductor heterostructure where the electrons are free to move in two spatial directions but are confined in one direction. So what I'm plotting here are the different subbands or vibrational states in a quantum Hall heterostructure. So this is the ground, the first and second excited states. And what I really want you to take home from this slide are two things. The first thing is the energy scales. The energy scales for single particle excitations in this confined direction are of order terahertz or 150 Kelvin. So this is a very sort of everyday kind of energy scale. And that's not surprising because these are actually devices that operate in cell phones and things like that. So these are typical energy scales. And the interaction energy scale is also fairly large. It's some large fraction of the vibrational energy spacing. So a couple terahertz, so maybe 50 Kelvin. The second point of this slide that's relevant is how the structure is manufactured. It's a fairly complicated series of semiconductor layers. So this is an aluminum gallium arsenide, and aluminum gallium arsenide. And it's an engineered structure that the two-dimensional electrons are free to move in. However, because it's in a semiconductor, it's sort of filled with various sources of disorder, chemical impurities, crystalline defects, and so on. So the electrons are not free to move without scattering in this potential. So what I'm going to focus on today is what I've gone on to, and this is a confined systems and atomic physics. So we start with a retroreflected laser beam, and I'm actually going to go into a little bit more detail about where we get this in the laboratory, but for now it's two laser beams propagating in opposite directions, which give rise to a standing wave potential. This is an intensity standing wave, and it's attuned to the red of the atomic resonance, so the atoms are attracted to the bright spots. In the laboratory, we can also tune to the blue of the atomic resonance, in which case the atoms are repelled from their bright spots and attracted to the places where there's no light. But this experiment, everything I'm going to describe today, is for a red-attuned laser beam. So the potential minima here correspond to the peaks in the optical potential. If I focus on a single site of the standing wave potential, the atoms can be here on the ground, first or second excited vibrational levels. But once again, let's go back to the energy scales. The separation between this level and this level is not terahertz like it was for the electron system, but it's kilohertz. So we've gone from an energy scale, which in temperature is about 150 Kelvin, to something that's about 3 microkelvin. So from the point of view of an experimentalist, this is a vastly different regime. Although from the point of view of theoretical physics, it doesn't really matter because the interaction energy is also scaled to a much smaller level. So from the point of view of the type of physics you can realize, these systems are quite similar to the semiconductor systems. Of course, here I have bosons, but these could just as well be fermions. So there's a similarity in the kind of physics you might tend to observe. Okay, but from my point of view as an experimentalist, the fact that it's much colder is an extremely significant factor. So this is a photograph of the apparatus that all the experiments I'll describe today was done in. So we have a source of rubidium atoms here. So I'm going to talk about rubidium 87 Bose-Einstein condensates. We heat it up to about 400 degrees Kelvin, and this sends a thermal beam of atoms propagating in this direction. This is a tapered solenoid, which counteracts the Doppler shift of the moving atoms with a Zeeman shift, putting in resonance with a laser beam propagating in the opposite direction. As these atoms scatter photons, they gradually decelerate, their Doppler shift decreases, and so does the magnetic field. So this is a Zeeman device that keeps velocity classes of atoms constantly in resonance with a single laser beam. So we go from atoms that are going about 350 meters per second at the entrance to the Zeeman slower to about 10 meters per second at this exit. We then capture these atoms in the magneto-optic trap, transfer to a purely magnetic trap, evaporate, and get our Bose-Einstein condensate. So all this evaporation and trapping happens in this region of the apparatus there. So this sort of light beige circle is a magnetic coil, and that other coils in there as well. So one thing you should remember about these experimental apparatuses is that it's pretty tightly confined geometry in there, and you have to poke extra laser beams in or get more magnetic fields in, so we always have a constraint of how much stuff can we get in there. And I think this picture pretty solidly illustrates how full our experiment is. Okay, so back to the more abstract. So we start with the Bose-Einstein condensate, and the profile of BEC might be given by the envelope of this blue curve here. And it has a typical spatial extent of about 20 microns. A BEC that I'll be talking about might have a total number of atoms of about 100 to 200,000 atoms. Okay, so that's our starting point of BEC. Now, when I say BEC, of course, nothing is perfect. A perfect BEC would have every atom in the condensed fraction. We don't have that. Typically, I start with a system where about 80% of the atoms are in the condensed phase, 20% are measurably thermal atoms. Okay, but let's take this ideal BEC picture. We then apply this retroreflected laser beam and partition the three-dimensional BEC into an ensemble of two-dimensional systems. And that's what's meant to be illustrated by these blue spikes here. Each of those is the density profile in the confined direction of a particular two-dimensional system. So this is one very large difference between these systems and the semiconductor system. This is more like a superlattice in the semiconductor system where you have many 2D systems. So here we might have 20 or 30 2D systems, each one having a spatial extent of, and this is the harmonic oscillator length, 43 nanometers, separated by half the wavelength of light, which in this case would give a separation of 410 nanometers. Okay, so everything I'm going to talk about today is an ensemble measurement. I create a great many 2D systems. I do something to them, and I measure the ensemble result. Okay. I'm also going to give units in terms of the photon recoil. This is the amount of energy an atom at rest would acquire if it spontaneously emitted a photon at some wavelength. That wavelength's up for me to pick, and I'm going to select the wavelength of light giving rise to my optical lattice. In that case, these energies are in kilohertz, which of course are relevant energy scales for the system. So 3.4 kilohertz or 14 picoelectron volts to connect back to the semiconductor systems. So these are, again, very tiny units of energy. So the photon recoil is my standard unit of energy for this talk. Okay, so back to what we do in the laboratory. The lattice I've been talking about so far, in fact, partitions the system into 2D systems which are vertically aligned. We call these pancakes. I'm probably going to slip into that terminology later on. So in the laboratory frame, we have a stack of two-dimensional systems aligned as I've illustrated here. The atoms in each of these systems are free to move in the two-dimensional plane, that is, without any gravitational potential in each of them. And here's how we do it. So the atoms are in a glass cell, so this glass cell would come in and out of the page here. I send a laser beam up through the cell, I bounce it off of two mirrors, and I send it back down again. So this isn't exactly a retroreflected laser beam as you might have envisioned, going like this, exactly back to back. There's a slight angle. And that slight angle is there for a very intentional technical purpose, and that is so that we can image the atoms looking up into the two-dimensional systems. So all the data I present is data taken by absorption imaging. So we shine resonant light through the atoms and take a picture of the shadow cast by the atoms. So this eyeball is my camera, and I'm looking up at the stack of two-dimensional systems. I could take a picture of the atoms in situ, that is, how they're distributed in these 2D pancakes, but the spatial extent of that's quite small, and you just see a high-density region. So that's not the data you want to take. Instead, you want to take these images after time of flight, these momentum distributions that we always speak of. So the basic idea I've schematically illustrated here, which I'm sure everyone in this audience already knows, you have some set of atoms, each of which might have some velocity, some moving faster than others. You remove all the confining potentials, you wait a while, and you take a picture of the resulting momentum distribution. But the point I want to make is this isn't really a momentum distribution. This little yellowish circle still has a finite extent even after the time of flight. So you're never going to be resolving anything spatially that's much smaller than the initial system size, and that therefore puts a limitation on the kind of momentum scales you can measure. So it's not a perfect momentum distribution even at this level. It's convolved with some kind of spatial function there.
So can I just ask, the 18 degrees, can you alter that?
The answer is, of course I can alter it. For this particular laser beam in the laboratory,
yes.
I can't.
Yeah,
but
I'm
we but we have constructed what we call an accordion lattice, which is a lattice where the beams intersect at an angle, and the angle is controlled by a galvanometer. So we can change the lattice constant from about 1.2 microns in that to about 10 microns in situ. And so we can do experiments. We load into a big lattice, compress the atoms down, and it'll do all that. So this gets at your answer. For this particular beam, no. Okay. All right. So we've created our two-dimensional system, and that's the beginning of these experiments. I want to talk about two-dimensional Bose-Hubbard systems. So we're going to come along with two more sets of laser beams, each one a counterpropagating pair, which generally creates a gently corrugated potential that these two-dimensional atoms are free to move in, or somewhat free to move in. Are there some details here that I want to mention? Yes. How many people were here for Trey Porto's talk a couple weeks ago? Again, in the spirit of complete disclosure, this is not a laser beam which is then retroreflected, and this is not a laser beam which is retroreflected. These beams are in a funny bow tie configuration where this beam comes across, retroreflects back, comes back, retroreflects back, again, and it looks like a bow tie. Provided the polarization of these laser beams is in the plane of the two-dimensional system here, then you get this standing wave potential. If the polarization of the light is out of the plane, then you have four-way cross interference, which gives rise to a different potential. These experiments were done in a situation where it looks like two retroreflected beams like that. But there are other great, very interesting experiments we can do in these type of condensed matter systems by having mixtures of these two potentials. And this is something I'd like to talk about offline with people if you guys are interested. Okay. Okay, so this then is the starting point for the kind of Bose-Hubbard experiments we want to do. We have some two-dimensional lattice potential. I'd like in your minds to think about just one 2D system, even though we do an ensemble measurement. I select the lattice depth, and for a particular lattice depth, the ratio T over U is selected. So I have my Bose-Hubbard system. I've not drawn a chemical potential in here, which has a tunneling strength, which I can calculate from band structure, an on-site interaction U, which I can calculate from band structure. So given the lattice depth, I know T over U. Okay, so that's what I need as an experimentalist. I have a knob, which is a lattice depth, and I have a control parameter, which determines the physics of the system. But coming from my background, one natural question is, how good of a representation of the Bose-Hubbard model are these 2D systems? So I talked about an on-site energy term, and this is the infamous on-site energy term, but in principle there's a nearest neighbor interaction term as well. And the nearest neighbor interaction term I'm going to discuss is not some kind of dipolar interaction. It's instead due to the fact that the localized Vanier functions aren't perfectly localized to a particular site. So even with delta function interactions, atoms on neighboring sites do have a finite overlap integral with one another, and thus a nearest neighbor interaction term. So what I'm plotting on this graph is the magnitude of the nearest neighbor interaction term with the on-site interaction term as a function of lattice depth. And I have various vertical lines drawn on this. But the really central point is by the time you're in a tight binding kind of limit, so you have a Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian you can write down, the ratio of this nearest neighbor term to the on-site term is down to almost just a couple parts in a thousand. So even when you just have a Bose-Hubbard model, a single band model, you have very weak nearest neighbor interactions. And by the time you get to a mod-insulator transition or a good mod-insulator, it's an extremely tiny contribution. So I really believe that in this sense we have an extremely good Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian.
How many atoms can you populate each well without the three-body losses and so on becoming too much?
I think we could do an experiment with three atoms per site. So once you put four, so I think one of my next slides, maybe even my next slide, is the actual timing for the experiment. So what we need to have to answer your question is that in the deepest lattice we go to, the densities have to be such that the three-body losses don't eliminate your population in about 30 milliseconds. Okay, so that gives you, maybe you could do four, you couldn't do five.
I think I heard a talk by Eric Carnell where he was talking about, well, he was talking there about costless lattice transitions from the lattices, and he had maybe thousands of atoms per set.
Okay, so if you think about just the one lattice that partitions a system into two-dimensional systems, those sites, if you will, have thousands of atoms in them. So my largest 2D system might have 4,000 atoms in it. But when you put on the further lattices in the 2D plane, then you have something that looks like one of these washboard potentials in all three directions. Then one site of that potential might just have a couple atoms in it. Okay.
So I think here I'm referring to that very site, which still has a pretty high population number.
What's the spatial extent of the site? I mean, I can make a...
It was very loud, yes.
Eric has 2D rods. I mean, he has his lenses, but then those are rods. Each one of them is about 1,000 particles. It's not that he has each site is 1,000 particles.
So his central size are very large.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cigars.
Yeah, he's got a bunch of spheres. 2D, well, he did the cheaper than arranging 2D, basically.
How much do you get interference between adjacent layers? Is that important in your observations? Because you just talked about an ensemble measurement.
Yes, okay, so...
Or is that something you're going to talk about later?
It's not something I talk about later. So all of my imaging is done looking up at the stack. Okay. So any interferences you would see between the layers, even if they were there, and they're for good reason they're not there, you actually integrate over. If you look sideways, in principle, you could see interference. And in fact, there's been some interesting experiments on 2D systems where you have just two of them, and you look from the side, and you see that. Yes, but if you looked at that vertically, you'd see exactly the kind of stuff I see. Now, they also don't have a lattice in the 2D plane.
Yeah, I know that you may not want to pursue people, but just continue to send you a question. I mean, even though the layers are incoherent, but then there are this issue about whether the measurement in themselves will induce some coherence between them. So if I look at, I mean, this the Castandela bar type of.
Uh-huh.
So the question is that when I look through them, then the fact that I just look through them will introduce phase coherence between different layers. So that we can.
Well, so. So you do have to be careful. The images we take are images after a time of flight. So in some particular volume element, there exist atoms whose trajectories could be traced back to any of the sites. So I think we can talk about what I measure later, but I think if you really think you're making a momentum measurement, let's say you're making that assumption, and let's say you could actually measure the momentum in all three directions, even though we take a projective measurement later on, then you just measure, you know, the population in some volume element and you integrate it out. So I think that the answer is no, we're safe. But let's get to this slide. So I think this is a well-placed slide in terms of these questions of coherence and correlations between layers. So what this slide is describing is the actual timing sequence we follow in a laboratory to create these 2D Bose-Hubbert systems. So I've talked about two sets of lattice beams, one set of lattice beam which partitions into 2D systems, and a second set of lattice beams which creates the two-dimensional lattice that the atoms then move in. So what we do in practice is first slowly turn on the lattice which partitions the system into 2D systems. Then about halfway through turning that lattice on, we begin turning on the second lattice which corrugates the potential. Okay, so you might think it would have been a better idea to turn the vertical lattice all the way on and then to turn on this 2D lattice. And we don't do that for very good experimental reason, and as we find that holding the atoms in these 2D sheets for a long time adds heat to the system. Part of this is vibrational heating, but I think it's dominated by off-resonance scattering of photons. You don't have to scatter too many photons to have a measurable impact on the temperature. You might think, well, okay, that's one way of doing it. Why don't we just turn on the lattices at exactly the same time? Well, this comes back to another experimental reality. The system initially is in a Joffre-Pritchard trap. That doesn't have to mean anything to you. All you have to remember is that the aspect ratio of this 3D trap is about 3 to 1 to 1. 3 in the spatial units in this direction and 1 and 1 in this direction. So it's somewhat cigar-shaped, more rugby football-shaped. However, when you begin applying the vertical lattice, that laser beam has a cylindrical profile, and it takes this football-shaped thing and begins to make it round. So the intuition we were following when we designed this profile was that we didn't want the system to enter the monocylating phase when it still had a deformation that it wanted to take to get into equilibrium. So instead, we make it have a roughly circular symmetry, and then we turn on the lattice in the remaining direction. So that's the intent behind this particular timing sequence.
So the anisotropy in the original trap is in the x and y direction,
so yeah. So the system is, if I call this direction x, this y, this z, I'm imaging along z, then the system size is 3 units in this direction, 1 unit in this direction, 1 unit in this direction. I mean, I only care about the ones in the XY plane. Yes.
I don't know the number, but presumably when you turn up the vertical lattice, eventually then it would dominate over the
Yes. So by the time it's all the way on, so I can switch. Let me switch to trapping frequencies as my my measure of anisotropy. Initially, the trapping frequencies are 11 hertz or between 9 and 11 hertz, depending on my choice of current, and 20 hertz in the tightly confined directions. Okay, so that's giving me about my 3 to 1 is 24 hertz. By the time the vertical lattice is at its full depth, the trapping frequencies are much more isotropic, and they're about 30 to 35 hertz in both directions. A fortunate consequence of this, which I was going to get to later, is the addition of this extra lattice hardly changes these trapping frequencies. They might go from 35 to 40 hertz. So we've done the dominant compression of the trap before we've really created our 2D systems. Okay, so we begin to divide the system into its 2D subsystems. We then apply a lattice which corrugates and creates the lattice in the 2D plane. Then we hold the system for 30 milliseconds in the desired parameter region for the Bose-Hubbard model we want to realize. We then abruptly turn off all the confining potentials, allow the atoms to ballistically expand for some time. Today I'll show data where the expansion time was either 20 or 30 milliseconds. For the most part, that doesn't matter. The reason you might want to go to larger times of flight is because the initial system size becomes smaller compared to the momentum scales. The reason you might not want to go to longer times of flight is the number of atoms in a particular bin of my detector gets smaller, and it gets more difficult to actually measure them. So this is an experimental reality. Someone might say, well, if this initial size matters, wait longer. Well, in practice, you can't necessarily do that.
Why do you only hold for 30 milliseconds?
I hold for the shortest possible time for the system to come into equilibrium.
Because if you have a deep enough optical lattice, presumably the tunneling is going to be longer than 30 milliseconds.
Yep. So 30 milliseconds is more or less an empirical time that we find by waiting long enough we don't see any further evolution of the system. Most of the equilibration has occurred during this turn-on period, which is hundred milliseconds. I'll take this chance to ask the experts in the audience. One might argue, I actually bought this argument initially, that you want to go slowly towards the end because the tunneling time becomes very, very long. Okay, so that makes sense. On the other hand, if you're thinking about sort of Landau-Zener tunneling, or you want to be adiabatic in that respect, the gap in the spectrum is of order U by the time you're in a mod-insulating phase. So one might argue that, in fact, in a mod-insulator, you can go fast, you don't have to wait near as long because the type of time scale associated with adiabaticity is that U. And in the lab, we find that not to be the case, nor do we find that times have to be the tunneling time. So these are the profiles that I used in the data I'm going to talk about today. Manuel Bloch's group has published a paper where they experimented with different possible profiles, so initially going up in this sort of exponential fashion and then turning over and slowing down towards the top. And they found that that kind of profile did, in fact, decrease the amount of energy deposited in the system. And I've done that kind of thing, too, and it indeed shows a bit of a difference. So I'm not certain exactly what the optimal profile is, and I think that's an interesting question to get at.
I don't understand the question. You said you have a question for
what? Yeah, so what's the time scale that determines adiabaticity? It's not U, it's not T.
There is a possibly longer time scale in the mod-insulating phase, which is if you've left some imbalance in doubly occupied and empty sites, the time scale for that to relax can be much longer.
But it's not of order T, is it?
It's not of order T. I mean, because basically they can't, you know, there's no way of them just recombining. Mm-hmm. So one has to somehow have some sort of three-body process involving some holes and some doubly occupied sites to allow some relaxation. So you absorb the U and the kinetic energy of the holes. But that can be quite slow if the gap's quite big.
Okay. So, yeah.
Can you put a bound on the
interlayer
hopping?
The hopping between the 2D systems?
Yeah.
So this vertical lattice is made to be a depth of about 30 recoils. In that case, the inverse time, the time associated with 1 over T is a little over a second.
In terms of ratio of T per over 2D.
Okay, so that's sort of shown in this graph here. This is, you know, logarithmically related to the tunneling, but most of the time the tunneling in the 2D direction is much, much faster than the tunneling in the remaining direction. However, I do go to lattice steps where they become comparable.
Is that what, 100?
Comparable means 1 to 1.
No, I'm sorry.
And in this case, yeah, the tunneling time in the So let's say we had 20 here. I would say it would be 5 to 1 or something, 10 to 1. But another reason to turn on the 2D lattice in advance is to sort of create essentially phase scramble these systems with respect to one another.
And how many 2D layers are there in the...
Maybe 60. Is everyone done with the slide now?
Thanks.
Okay. Okay, so I'd like to give some representative data that we take. In this case, representative means pretty good, but not the best I've ever taken. So what I'm showing are single images of atoms after time of flight crossing the superfluid to insulated transitions. Well, not crossing. These are all in the non-insulating phase. So we see some correlations here, fewer correlations here, and a featureless blob there. So these are sort of representative of this famous kind of data looking at a non-insulated transition. And most of what I'm going to talk about today is going to focus on the non-insulating phase. So here we have what's a very good non-insulator. There's essentially no structure to this blob except the blob's shape itself. When the lattice is a little bit shallower, some structure appears, and yet shallower, structure still further develops. Each of these pictures is taken in the region where we have a mod insulator, and what's happening here is that we don't have just one atom per site. Instead, the system is described by having an admixture of these particle hole-like states. So if you take this trial wave function and ask what should the momentum distribution for that be, it predicts this cosinusoidal structure. You can compare the prediction of this perturbation expansion with what I measure, and they lie right on top of one another. So that's very good. This is for a 2D system, and it's also been done for 3D systems. Some other features that appear on lines on these graphs. These black lines delineate the different Brillouin zones you would have if you were talking about quasi-momentum. And quasi-momentum is what I want to talk about next. So as a rule of thumb, when I read a theory paper, they talk about quasi-momentum distributions and not momentum distributions. In practice, in the lab, we could measure quasi-momentum distributions directly. This is another measurement trick. What we would do is we'd create the system we want to study, realize the Hamiltonian, and then turn off the lattice, not instantaneously, but not really slowly either, in a couple hundred microseconds. This time scale is adiabatic with respect to single particle excitations, but diabatic with respect to the many-body system. So what you end up doing is mapping the quasi-momentum state to an outgoing momentum state. So if you do this in a good non-insulator, you see a square with your camera. So the lowest Brillouin zone is fully occupied. And if you do this for a superfluid, you get back a single peak in the center. So one could do this and directly measure, or nearly directly measure, the quasi-momentum distribution. But we find that in practice, this kind of data is sort of curvy at the edges. So another way of measuring the quasi-momentum distribution to compare better with theory is to observe how these momentum distributions are related to the quasi-momentum distribution. And the relation is very, very simple. If n of k is the momentum distribution, so this is a dagger a each at k, and then it's related to the quasi-momentum distribution simply by an enveloping Vanier function. And we know the Vanier function because we know the lattice so well. So what you could do in practice is you could take this data, you could say, okay, I know the Vanya function, I'm going to divide by it, and then you could do some kind of averaging to get the quasi-momentum distribution. Now, as experimentalists, we're a little bit more clever. We have some lowest noise way of doing that, but in the end, we can go from these momentum distributions to what the quasi-momentum distribution is. So in the mod-insulator phase, the quasi-momentum distribution is featureless. As correlations develop between sites, the quasi-momentum distribution develops structure, which increases as the lattice becomes more shallow. So can we be more quantitative? And the answer is yes. If I take a cross-section through this quasi-momentum distribution, that cross-section is these black dots here, here, and here for an increasingly deep optical lattice. The red curve is the prediction of theory. In this case, I looked up an RPA theory, and you see that for each of these curves, the RPA theory does a very good job of predicting what the quasi-momentum distribution should be. However, because part of this talk is in the spirit of full disclosure, I could have another panel up here where T over U is maybe 50 times 10 to the minus 3. And that slide, the measured quasi-momentum distribution would not agree with the RPA result. And the reason is RPA is a mean field theory. And in these systems, mean field theories systematically predict that superfluid insulator transition occurs at smaller values of T over U than it actually does. So in a reasonably deep lattice, just a fourth order perturbation theory works. In a slightly more shallow lattice, you need to add RPA. To have agreement with experiment at higher order, you need more sophisticated theory, even in RPA. But nevertheless, I can also use the RPA to predict what the higher order Fourier terms in this should be. I can measure those terms and compare with theory. And just like for the first order terms, we find very good agreement with the second order terms. So the point here is we do have a pretty good understanding of what's going on in terms of these systems. We really do create what we think we're creating.
But what's the difference between the red and the blue dots?
On this one?
On the experiment on the left.
The red and the blue dots?
On the red.
Here?
Dots and blue dots.
And the data.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's just my color scale.
Okay. Where's blue?
Where's blue? There's lower density, and red is higher density.
Okay.
I guess it maybe was clearer here, where you just sort of saw a smooth progression.
Right. So what? Oh, then white just means.
It's somewhere in between.
Okay. So
yeah.
Like
yeah. Okay. So I'm going to have a couple slides now talking about what we can observe about the transition between insulator and superfluid. So the bottom axis in this graph is lattice depth, and the vertical axis is peak width. So I construct the quasi-momentum distributions as I described before. They have a peak. I can empirically measure the 4th at half max of that peak. That doesn't mean I fit to a Lorentzian or anything. It means I find the lowest spot, the highest spot, find the point in between. I call that the 4th at half max. So this is a very empirical measure of the width of the peak. I'm not assuming a model function or anything like that. It genuinely is the 4th at half max, and it's the 4th at half max along this cross section. Okay, so you have to pick a cross section. If this were sort of the cosinusoidal distribution characteristic of the first order perturbative results, there's in fact a different half widths along different directions. Okay, so we plot the 4th at half max as a function of lattice depth. Initially it's fairly narrow, then very abruptly it begins increasing. So the blue dashed line is a semi-empirical fitting function that I use to try to characterize this data. And using that fitting function, one can identify the transition between superfluid and insulator to an accuracy of about one recoil. So we say 9.3 plus or minus one recoil. The results from DMRG, which I cite down here, give it at 9.1 recoils. So we, again, agree pretty well theory. DMRG should be a pretty accurate calculation of this transition.
DMRG is 1D,
though. 2D. This is, I think so. It's look. This paper definitely is 2D. I guarantee that.
It's more likely to be Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
Okay.
DMRG is very hard to do in 2D.
Okay.
It's maybe they have a new technique. I think it's with quantum Monte Carlo.
Yeah. Okay.
That's quantum Monte Carlo.
Okay.
And that numeric takes into account the trap shape.
The paper includes both. Okay, so yeah. So this fitting function is semi-empirical and semi-physics based. So I know what the 4th to half max should be at in a very deep lattice. You only have this cosinusoidal term. And you know that in the superfluid phase, it should be more or less constant. And then I have something that interpolates in between. So you might not believe that this is a very good representation. So I'm following the wrong sequence here. Right.
So can you say the last sentence again?
I'll re-say the last sentence when I come to the next slide. I'd forgotten that this one was in between.
Okay,
fine. Okay. So I added this slide because I want, again, to be as fully disclosive as possible. So up to now, I haven't written a Hamiltonian down that has a chemical potential in it. And part of that is because in the laboratory, we don't have a chemical potential meter. We have an atom number meter. We count how many atoms we have. We don't know what the chemical potential is. I could tell you ways of measuring it. You could image in situ and see how big your 2D system is, and that size is related to the chemical potential. But really, I measure a number of atoms, and I know T of Ryu because I determine the lattice depth. So using those two pieces of information and some model of the chemical potential related to the density, one can self-consistently determine what the chemical potential had to be to give the number of atoms that we actually had. So in this graph, this is what I've done. I've plotted what the chemical potential is inferred to be given a mean field theory result, which I can easily calculate, and the lattice depth of the number of atoms. So what these blue dots are is the inferred chemical potential at the center of our system for each of the data points over here. Okay, so this is the maximum chemical potential. As you go across, it changes, and that's because the harmonic confining potential is changing, U is changing with respect to those terms, and the density here vertically is also changing. So this gives a chemical potential which changes at different lattice depths in practice. All right. Now the black dot here is my measurement of where this transition occurs. So it's not located in one of the blue points, and why is that? Well, the blue points represents the maximum chemical potential. So if I want to say, what's my best estimate of the chemical potential when this transition occurred, I take the average chemical potential over the system. That's what that black dot is. Okay. what else am I being fully disclosive about? Well, this particular graph is designed such that the density goes to zero as the chemical potential goes to zero. And that's not the case for this Hamiltonian. In this Hamiltonian, in fact, the density goes to zero at some negative value of chemical potential as you go out this way. And that's because this, the way the lattice, the way this tunneling term is done, it goes negative for...
you mean the phase boundary of this graph is not as, it's, strictly speaking, it's not that accurate because you calculated by that assumption?
No. I'm getting there. So this graph is right. I just added a term to the Hamiltonian which made zero energy occur. If you put all the atoms into the lowest quasi-momentum state, I make that zero. And that is not the case for this Hamiltonian. And I'm telling this to you guys because this is a confusion for experimentalists. Usually, in this field, people think that when the chemical potential goes to zero, so does the number. Okay? That's because you have this GP equation stuck in your head, and that's sort of what it means at the end of the system. So this is, I've had several discussions, and by adding a term to the Hamiltonian, you can make that confusion go away. Okay. So... Right, so I was talking about my empirical fitting function. So you can take the same empirical fitting function, I can pull the data out of this paper, plot them on my graph, and fit the same fitting function, and it works pretty well. Okay, so this is just some justification. I've chosen an empirical function that captures the type of data one expects to see as a function of lattice depth pretty well. All right. Okay, so back to facts about what we measure. So again, we're measuring positions of atoms after time of flight, not momentum distributions, even though I insist on talking about, quasi-momentum. So there are fundamental limits on how small of a peak you can expect to measure. One of these limits is the initial size of the system. Another of these limits is a Fourier transform limit, right? Even if you are measuring momentum or quasi-momentum, you can never measure anything smaller than 1 over the initial system size. Both of these together combine to give a limit of about this line. This line, in fact, only incorporates the initial system size, which for these data is somewhat larger than the Fourier transform limit. This slide also showed at the March meeting. It's talking about what we observe in terms of a condensate fraction as a function of T over U. So what's the meaning of this graph? So we have data where I've extracted the quasi-momentum distribution. If you take a cross-section through it in the superfluid phase, it looks not unlike a BEC. There's a pedestal upon there's a peak upon a pedestal. So one can fit to this and look for how many atoms are actually in the peak. So it's a bimodal distribution. I'm not going to assign a particular large physical meaning to anything, merely to say that there's some fraction of the atoms which I will call condensed atoms. This fraction hovers around 35% until the superfluid insulator transition takes place and it drops to zero. There's a couple of reasons why it's dropping to zero here. Probably we're doing some heating. But in addition, right around here, this becomes a very strongly interacting superfluid. So like the case for liquid helium-4, not very many of the atoms would be in the condensed phase fraction anyway, even at zero temperature. So I don't have any more interpretation of this for you. But in our particular case, this system isn't so sensitive to the type of heating that's described in this paper because we already made the system round and are hardly changing the trapping potentials during the experiment.
But you'd expect something with an experiment, wouldn't you, anyway? Maybe hard to measure.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's heating going on. I mean, of course I can fit it something with an exponent. And I just wouldn't trust the results worth anything.
I mean, the thing that's interesting is just how flat the thing on the left is. Your diagram on the left of the transition.
Oh, down here?
Yeah.
Well, let's...
No, sorry, in the left-hand diagram.
Oh, sorry. Over here?
Width? Yeah, because you might have expected, as when you go into this region where you do get some shift in the...
So be careful. I've tricked you with the axes, right? This is lattice depth here, and this is T over U here. So it's compressed and flipped. This is the superfluid side here, and this is the superfluid side there.
I'm just making sure. But that was okay. But it's more that you do have this region where you do see some change in the condensate depletion on the right-hand diagram.
Yes, and you don't see it.
And you would therefore think that the quasi-momentum distribution would start to swell as that happened.
Yeah, so
and you see nothing on the left, and you're saying that's just because the scale's compressed.
No. So let's see if I can... I'm doing this on the fly. I might miss by one point.
Yeah.
But I think that point is that point.
Okay. So it's in the gray region.
In this region sort of here, certainly within the gray region, which represents by uncertainties, there's also a significant coexistence between superfluid and insulator spatially.
Yeah.
So you're not just having this isotropic system effect.
Yeah.
So in terms of measuring this critical point, I think we do pretty well because we're just asking the question, when does the first itty-bitty bit of mod insulator appear? Right, so, and then we're just seeing when the width begins to change. But there's we're certainly not extracting all the information possible from this. I tried simple parameters as much as possible.
I think this is the best data for the transition for the insulator I've seen, because most of them, they don't show the three-dimensional ones. I've not seen anything like this. This is very good, I think.
I'm not certain why it worked out so well. I mean, I don't...
Yeah, actually, that's a very brief, but
I was motivated.
Anything like this, I don't think one has any problem.
Yeah, I was motivated by this paper. I mean, everyone has always said that there's no sharp signature of the mod insulator superfluid transition and momentum distributions. And I happened to find this on the archive, and it looked very sharp to me. And indeed, it matches pretty well.
I mean, the suggestion is that if it is a first order phase transition, it must be a very weakly first order. Could it be just the second order phase transition?
I certainly can't make any statement like that.
Well, you can, but there's a significant enough suppression of the condensate fraction.
Yeah.
When you go from deep inside the phase.
Uh-huh. Right, but I want to remind you that this condensate fraction should be interpreted very loosely. Because in this region of coexistence, if you have some region of superfluid and some region of insulator, the insulator in this fit would look just like uncondensed atoms.
Okay. I thought the advantage of your experiment is that my understanding from what you're plotting this loop is that you don't have the wetting cake structure, you just have... It's just one block with each pancake.
Right.
You only have one super
plate. Yes. That's absolutely true. So if this is the harmonic confinement, and you're getting into the region where there's some mod insulator, some superfluid, then I pick the density such that the peak is 1, right? But around the edges, the density goes to 0 like this. So there's a shell of superfluid around the edge. And I had a slide of that up here. What the heck has just happened? These things are a little too fancy. That's this one. So this T over U is 0.025. This is mean field theory, but that's for this point. Okay. And I think it's not too far from being right. So you have a ring of superfluid around the edge of the mod insulating region. Okay. And you should remember that, again, this is one 2D system. Really, we have an overall spherical density distribution. So the whole core of that 3D distribution is 2D mod insulator with a ring of superfluid around the whole thing. So to count the atoms right, you need to remember it's a 3D system overall.
I think, actually, you should use the word condensate fraction even more carefully. I mean, you already stated one problem.
Uh-huh.
But in a strictly two-dimensional system, you would have a finite condensate fraction only at zero temperature. At any non-zero temperature,
yes,
the condensate fraction should be zero.
Right. So for
the
no, wait.
I understand.
For a
2D.
So. So for this system.
Tell me about what happens as a result of the
fraction. The y is not that.
So there's. There's a couple, I've spent some time thinking about this and discussing with my atomic physics colleagues. For these systems, you couldn't, I think even for a very big system, looking at time of flight images, you couldn't tell a difference. And the reason is we see a bimodal distribution, and the width of the bimodal part is quite broad. And this is due to initial size effects and the forces during expansion the atoms are exerting upon one another. So what you say is right, that in a 2D system, you have no finite, no macroscopic occupation of any state, but you do have a very, very sharply peaked momentum distribution
this
upon that. So we would see that.
Describes at least in the bulk, and now how that's modified by the presence of the trap.
Yeah. Yep. So this is the fraction of the atoms that look like they're in one peak. I mean, I can. That's all we've done.
Sorry to interrupt. I mean, if I don't know whether it's 2D or 3D or anything, I just put these two graphs onto the same plot. Right. So the condensate fraction is coming. Coming down from left. If I plot on that.
Yeah. So it would be high, and it come down.
And the width of the momentum distribution on the mod
inserting stuff down. So the two seem to be almost matching. They don't exactly.
Yeah, so what's going on there is that the part of the distribution that I associate with the condensate fraction always has the same width, more or less. You know, that's the data there on the right. So that what's happening is, as long as that peak is there, you don't see too much of a change to the fourth of half max. As it gets shorter and shorter and shorter and contributes a smaller fraction of the system, you see a slight increase. But as soon as it becomes comparable in height to the pedestal upon which it sits, then you begin to measure the fourth of half max of that pedestal, not the condensate peak.
I was saying much more naive thing, which is that if I just look at these two curves, one coming from the other side, and the other one coming from the further side, they seem to be more or less.
Well, it's the same data, so yeah.
I see.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I think the question is why it's so flat on the left hand side. That's something very curious.
This one? My guess is that I'm not actually seeing any change in size. I mean, my other guess is that they didn't see much here either. That's not a guess, that's an observation. I think the point is that as soon as you say it's 3D and you do have a condensed fraction, as soon as you have a condensed fraction, you're measuring, that goes off to infinity, so you're measuring the width of a delta function.
It's just you think experimentally you'd measure something about the depletion in K-space, which you might think will get more pronounced as you approach the transition.
It seems that it's not much of it. Okay. So far I've talked about measuring momentum distributions. And what I'd like to remind you is that typically we take a picture of the atoms, like that one. That's an image of the atoms, one shot, and we call that the momentum distribution. But there have been a great many theoretical and now a couple experimental results out telling us that this isn't the momentum distribution, that's a momentum distribution. So when I say the momentum distribution, I said talking about the expectation value of that operator, right? That's the momentum distribution. This is just the coordinates of atoms after time of flight. Right, I measured something. What I'd need to do to get the momentum distribution is average a great many of these shots together, and then I would have, that's what quantum mechanics tells us, is the prescription for acquiring the expectation value of operators, repeat measurements. In these systems, this is a really powerful observation, because what I can do is take this image and perform some mathematical operation on it, and then I will have measured the mathematical operation on that image. If I then take the average, it's not the same as taking the average of that mathematical operation on the average. So the averaging doesn't necessarily commute with the functions. So that's a very general statement. What I'm going to talk about is measuring correlation functions using this technique. So what we do is we take a whole bunch of images like that, we average them together and acquire the average momentum distribution. We then subtract that average from each and every one of those images, and we have noise. We have no average density of atoms, we just have the fluctuations. And I compute the correlation function of those fluctuations, and I can compare with the expectation value of delta n of k and delta n of k plus delta k, and one's integrating here over k, the two original coordinates. So I'm going to produce figures whose axes are delta k. That is, how likely is it to have found an atom here contingent upon having found an atom also there? So the actual function I'll be plotting is what I'm calling S, which is this correlation function normalized by the correlation function of the initial momentum distribution. And what the effect that this actually does is transfer us from momentum distribution to something that is invariant upon translation of a lattice momentum. So it goes back to quasi-momentum once again. And the expected results for perfect Fock states, that is being an Amott insulator, is a diffraction-like structure, so this is multi-slit diffraction from classical optics, and it's also, in this case, this noise correlation structure. So these are peaks whose width decreases as the number of atoms, as the system size increases, and whose area also decreases as the system size increases. And you can gain an intuition about what's going on thinking about classical optics again. So if you have a series of sources, as the number of sources increases, the Fourier width decreases, so you see the width decreasing. We're looking at noise here. So as the number of sources increase, the scale of the fluctuations also decreases. You'd say it decreases as root n, but here we're actually looking at something like a root mean squared thing without the root, so just something squared. So you have 1 over n instead of 1 over root n. I have this comment, the area is robust, underlined, and the reason for that is even if you have some convolution things like initial system size, you don't expect that the number of atoms participating in these correlation peaks should change, just that the width should change. Okay, so what we do, we measure these momentum distributions. These now are averages of momentum distributions, each one between 80 and 120 shots. So they look a lot smoother than the data I showed before. We subtract these averages from each image, and we compute the correlation functions and normalize.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yep.
So in this data, though, you have many pancakes. Is it already averaged over these pancakes?
So I'm looking upwards. So once you integrate along the pancake direction, there's an effect for having many pancakes, but it's taken account in. So
can you say it again? I mean, so pancakes are in these directions you're looking through them.
Yeah, so absolutely. So we did an expansion, and we now have a 3D cloud of atoms. We assumed that you had an initial 3D distribution of atoms on lattice sites. You project out one direction, and you get the result I did.
Yes. So that means that you've averaged over all pancakes.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And this is not particularly different from the fact that I average over all pancakes to get the momentum distributions as well.
Okay. What I'm trying to understand is why do you need to then, on top of it, to take many shots and repeat the experiment?
Okay. So, right. It's already not good that I'm averaging over many systems. Right. Ideally, I'd have one system, and the result of that would be that the magnitude of the noise compared to the background would be larger. Each of these subsystems, approximately speaking, contributes the same momentum distribution, but with different noise. Right. So then when I do this averaging, as you describe, I decrease the magnitude of the noise I have in one shot from what it would have been if I had one signal. So the momentum distribution, like you're saying, doesn't really depend. This is some kind of ergodic kind of argument we're making. But the noise already goes down by a factor of root n. Scaling is the number of systems. So it makes it even more important that I have to average. I'm trying to determine the properties of noise. And I have a signal-to-noise problem in measuring the noise.
Mm-hmm.
No, seriously, in principle, if you could do it in one realization. But because of this, actually, the reason you could do that is this integral over space builds up some signal-to-noise for you in your measurement.
Well, I thought Victor's question was that the fact that you have many pancakes already would help already.
No, it's a huge hindrance. And the reason was my original comment. For this technique to work, I have to have a measurement to which I apply my mathematical operation and then average.
Right.
Having many pancakes has done averaging first. It actually hurts you quite a bit. If you had an infinite number of pancakes, just going from up to plus and minus infinity, you did a projective image of all of them, you would get the momentum distribution. You get this quantity. And I can't compute correlation functions from that quantity.
Then I don't understand why this would also work that well in presence of this pancake. I mean, you say that by doing many copies, but some
many copies,
many runs, then somehow the effect of this, you have many layers, is reduced.
No. I never reduce the effect of having many layers. I can merely do the calculation and tell you what the noise should be if I've already integrated across those layers.
So in other words, when you're computing this delta n times delta n, each of these delta n's is already...
Yeah, there's already an integral here. This would be n of x, y, and z, and I integrated out z. So anyway, here's the data. So you see peaks, each one separated by a reciprocal lattice vector. And what I'm showing are the same measurement at different values of the lattice depth. So in the spirit of full disclosure, once again, everything here works perfectly in terms of the analysis. Everything here works perfectly in terms of the analysis. If I just blindly did what I described to you for this image, I would not get that result. And the reason is these calculating these correlation functions, as I described, is exquisitely sensitive to the existence of structure in the initial images. So from a technical point of view, if I calculated the correlation function of this and tried to subtract off an average, I would inevitably find that shadows of these diffraction peaks would reappear in the in the calculated noise correlation function, even though I don't expect them to be there. And the reason for that is every system we create doesn't actually have the same number of atoms in it. This is an experiment. We realize a BEC. We do something to it. We measure it. They might have a typical number fluctuation of 10 or 20% even. In addition, the lattice depth varies slightly from shot to shot. So while it's actively intensity stabilized, it might vary by a couple percent depending on things. That means the actual sharpness of these peaks is changing from shot to shot to shot. So that means further, the average, it doesn't necessarily represent very well a particular shot. So if I just subtract it off that average, one has structure in the difference at the location of those sharp diffraction peaks. So what we do in practice to get this data is we mask out the regions under these peaks and it completely ignore the atoms that are there. Okay. And it turns out that for the integrated correlation function we use here, if you do the normalization there, this type of masking is a safe thing to do. And I don't have a proof of that mathematically. I just have a whole lot of simulations where I've gone through turning various cranks and
masking,
found that to be the
You're masking off the bright area and then cover it as the weak area? Is that what,
what we do is we multiply by a masking function, which is 1 almost everywhere and 0 where there are too many atoms.
When there are too many atoms,
what I do is I, in fact, draw little circles in the center of each of these Brewer 1 zones and get rid of them all.
Okay.
And I do that for both the quantity, in the numerator and the denominator.
I see.
So I act as if the measured momentum distribution had holes in it. And remarkably, that's a safe thing.
Okay.
Which one?
So if everything works perfectly, S would be, the magnitude would be 1.
One over n.
1 over n, I see. So n
is, well, there's
n is what? The number of on each layer, the whole
total. Total.
All the pancakes.
Yeah, this n includes the fact that you had to integrate through. So I mean, everything I've done here is sort of one dimensional, but this n, let's see, with this n, I may be fibbing it. This n, I think what I told you is right and what I've plotted is wrong. So this would probably be n cubed because n here means the linear extent of the system.
I guess what I'm trying to see that, so what's the difference between, is there any major difference between the theoretical estimates, suppose everything worked perfectly at t equals 0, and the actual intensity, because the false color cannot see intensity yet.
So this is a plot of the integrated area under the noise correlation peaks. The black symbols are measurements at a great many different lattice depths. So each one of these points constitutes about 100 images. And the red curve is my expectation of what the noise signal should be, given the changing size of the mod insulator region as you approach the superfluid insulator point, reduced by 45%. So I see half the signal I think I should see.
This one should be somewhere up
there. The red line should be up here somewhere. So it's as if about half the correlations are gone. But if you just assume that they're gone, take that point, then you see the right trend.
Thank you very much. Yes.
So I don't know where the signal went. We can make our hand waving and say, well, the atoms interact during time of flight or something. But I don't know. So I don't know about that.
So he's
proposing temperature. Supposing you had a classical system, a lattice with a bunch of marbles in it, and you tossed a Poissonian distribution of marbles in each of the slots, and then you did this experiment with those classical marbles, you'd get the same answer. You have no effect.
Classical marbles,
you get the same answer. This is Hambury-Brown twists. You do it with thermal light from stars, you get this answer. So I'm merely saying it could be temperature, but it's not obvious to me.
Same answers as the red curve?
As the classical, it's the red curve right here, the 4. This is a statistical effect having to do with the fact you have atoms on lattice sites. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that. I've done pretty simple calculations. For example, I've taken a classical system and looked at its momentum distribution where I put zeros and ones or Poissonian distribution of atoms on it and looked at the momentum of that as defined by taking its Fourier transform of the density. And you do get this result out. Okay. So that's an observation. It's not a calculation. It's a numerics. Okay, so I don't know why it's suppressed. We can't come up with a good reason for it. We make arguments about interactions during time of flight. Temperature would be nice. It might be, you know, some profile issue. I don't know.
I think, I don't want to interrupt too much. This seems you are deep in the mark limit. Presumably some region deep in the mark limit, and that is that's limited. One can actually do a calculation and find temperature. I think it's something that one can calculate, so but it is useful.
Uh-huh.
It's something that can be done.
Okay. So the second parameter, which I said has something to do with the actual physics of the system are the width of these correlation peaks. So what I'm plotting here are the measured widths as a function of t over u. They stay about constant, and near the critical point, they kind of go up, but our error bars are large. Measuring width, as it turns out, was a hard thing to do. This was actually what I thought would be the killer of this experiment, measuring width. But unfortunately, the things that limit the widths we can measure are quite significant. So I'm including all the known resolution limits, which are the resolution of my optical system and the Fourier transform limit, but I'm not including the initial size of the system. And I don't know why I'm not including that. So don't laugh, but these peaks are much narrower than anything we have ever seen in the momentum distributions. So it is as if these noise correlations are less sensitive to the initial size than momentum is. I don't have a reason why that might be true. If you do some naive averaging, you find that it's not true, but we do see quite narrow peaks compared to momentum distributions. This, what I mean by quite narrow is half the width. Okay.
Is that somehow related to the fact that you masked off the peaks in the distribution?
Maybe here it might. Most of the atoms are not in the masked region, or in the mass region. But down here, the width is entirely independent of the masking. And that the reason, of course, is that most of the atoms aren't under the mask. Okay, so I have part two, momentum noise correlations. So the question I want to ask is, what is this integral all about? Okay, why am I performing an averaging? So let's think about one-dimensional systems for a little bit. So instead of having kx and ky, let's say we have kx, and we compute if we compute this expectation value without the average, and what you see are a series of bright spots. Those correspond to the peaks in my images, and you see some dark troughs. So what this integral is doing for you is projecting along these peaks. So instead of seeing a line, you just average all that weight up into a single point. And from a technical point of view, this is...
I don't understand what that figure... What is that figure?
It's not labeled so well. The vertical axis is kx, and the horizontal axis is ky, or kx and kx primed. So I'm talking about a 1D system now, not my 2D systems. And I'm plotting the expectation value of n of k1 times delta n of k2. Without this integral. So it's the same thing I have plotted as the autocorrelation function without the integral over k1 and k2.
And the axis, the axis are against...
This is k1 and k2.
Okay, I see.
So this axis is delta k, mm-hmm. And this axis is k1 plus k2. And we're essentially integrating out k1 plus k2. And for this case, which is calculated for Fox states, this is exactly the right thing to do because there is absolutely no structure whatsoever along that direction. So I've said we have a signal-to-noise problem, so of course you want to integrate it out. You look like you have a question? No. Okay. But if you include higher order terms, so I say, well, my wave function in the shallower lattice isn't just Fox states, it has T over U order corrections. Well, then, structure does appear in both kx and ky, kx plus ky, or k1 plus k2, and k1 minus k2 axes. So this is what you expect the order T over U contribution to this correlation function to be. And I've written something a little bit different here than I did before, and there's a reason for this. If this minus were a plus, then it would be the correlation function I talked about before. So the delta function does one integral for you. This is one-dimensional. But if you make it minus minus, then you look about along projections onto k1 plus k2. Now, this is a really silly thing to write down, except that there exist lots of integral transforms that conveniently calculate things that look like that. And in particular, I calculated that correlation function, and you see that there's weak structure here. And you might get very excited and say, that's fantastic, Ian, that corresponds to this. But one point I want to make is that that's not exciting. That's regular atom shot noise, and that's because along this line of kx plus ky is 0, that kx minus ky is 0, that corresponds to looking at noise at one point. And then if you integrate and look at projections onto this axis, you're dominated by that regular shot noise. Okay, so you're just seeing a peak there because there are more atoms there. But there are a whole class of correlation functions that look like this that could be computed extremely efficiently as well. So the point of this slide is I'm inviting you as theorists to think of correlation functions that look like that are interesting. Or give me an integral transform in a correlation function and I can very easily calculate it from my data. What I cannot do very easily is compute an arbitrary correlation function with a bunch of operators. And that's just a practical thing. I have data which is 512 by 512. I have 100 of them. It might not be easy to calculate. So this is an invitation for predictions with data ready to look at it.
Well, but can you, so how many points correlation function can you
Well, there's a noise issue. The integral transform these are all Fourier transforms, and it's the numerics are equally fast no matter how many you have here. But in terms of uncertainty, basically you're actually asking about phase uncertainty, and I don't know the answer to that. But certainly having four ends is probably pretty realistic.
Do you ask if this is possible for you to get a reasonably good data?
I think so. Look, the thing is, I don't have any signature to look for, so I don't know what my baseline is.
When 2 years ago when I asked Marcus, and he was very interested in doing higher correlation because he thought it was not possible.
I think in general it's hard. The reason this works is you do the Fourier transform, and then you notice if you integrate almost everything out, you always get a delta function. And you can pick by raising the things in your Fourier transform to some power what these plus and minuses are. Okay, so that's the nature of this trick. So I think that, look, if you gave me 20 n's, I probably wouldn't trust my data. But again, it's also a correlation function only of density. In any case, that was my last slide, and here are my conclusions.
I have a question. When you've shown the slide when you go a certain line across the fluid transition somewhere in this red.
Just a second. Is it momentum data or correlation? This kind of data?
No, that's just the phase diagram. It's not the phase diagram and your path.
Oh yeah, this one.
Yes. Is there any chance to hit this lobe?
There?
I was thinking that this black point is basically where the transition is not of the first order, presumably, but of this different kind, mm-hmm. right? I mean, just at the peak of the load.
Where would you like me to hit?
Could you pass by this point?
This?
Sorry?
I'm having...
he wants you to... tune your system so that this line, this data pass through that particular point.
Is there any chance that you can do it?
There's too many that's here. I don't know which one you're talking about. It's the red button on that one. The tip of the lobe?
Yes, the tip of the lobe. You can like that. Because the transition here along this line is very different from this one.
Right. So what's happening right now?
And you like to cross it.
So in this system,
not in this particular point.
Well, we are crossing it on a collection of points, and that's the thing, right? The system, because the system is inhomogeneous. Yes, the first point that hits is always the tip, as long as you have sufficiently large number of atoms. You always hit first there. Then you form in this case you initially form a ring of mod insulator, which then turns into a shell, like I've sketched there. Mm-hmm. So. By picking the number of atoms, you can always select a density low enough that you hit down here somewhere, and you only grow from underneath. You could do that, but if you pick a larger number of atoms, maybe twice here, you might hit there. You'd also start growing from there in the other direction. That's sort of a picture from the wedding cake structure. But I could always reduce the number of atoms and look at the underbelly of the lobe.
So what is the roughly the line on the left hand side of the figure? Is that from this? Yeah.
So that blue line is my sort of, that's a fitting function, and I put some physics into it, but not a whole lot.
Oh, it's and the, not from the, this table?
No. So this function was designed to determine what the critical point is. And then to validate the fitting function, I fit their numeric results to the same function and found out that it has enough free parameters to capture the kind of data you expect to see. Yeah. Actually, there's an unasked question back here first.
When you work out the classic momentum distribution, you were talking about using Manier functions for that?
Yeah. So let me. If it was this way, say this one. Yeah.
Yes. Does it matter which Manier functions you use for how well they're localized?
What do you mean by which?
I mean, if you work out the Manier functions probably as a superposition of Bloch.
function. Yes, in the lowest band.
You can choose whatever phases you like first. And depending on how you choose the phases, the Van Leer functions will look differently. Does this matter here, or does that just cancel out?
I think that there must be a best choice. And I chose a naive one that corresponds to looking like harmonic oscillators in the bottom of the well.
So you didn't really work out the Van Leer functions, but you used...
I worked out the Van Leer functions. I've done that. But I chose the Van Leer functions that looked most like Gaussians. The point is, though, that there is structure here. So this data fits extremely well to a Gaussian. Okay, in the deep mod insulator region. So that choice of Van Leer functions has to be the right one in the deep lattice limit. So we maybe might want to talk later, because you're alluding to knowledge that I don't have and I would like to. Okay, so...
Can you comment on whether there are efforts that needs to determine the temperature of the system? And what are the ideas?
My postdoc proposal was one in measuring temperature. And the answer is yes, we're very interested in measuring temperature. So I can give you two ideas that we have for measuring temperature. One was my postdoc idea, which we never did. Measuring temperature is easy if you don't have a BEC. So if you had Maxwell-Boltzmann atoms, they always have a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, you could measure that. Provided the density is low enough, you never actually nucleate a BEC, this low density of bosons would still look like a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So using that, you could always measure the temperature. But unfortunately, we don't have atoms without a lattice. So we have atoms in the lattice, which is what complicates measuring the temperature. So the idea was to tune the lattice to such a point that one atomic species did not see the lattice and the other one did. In which case, you can separately image them, and as long as they're colliding amongst one another and they're in relative thermal equilibrium, the temperature of the ancillary atoms would tell you the temperature of the atoms in the lattice. Okay. So you can do this with two hyperfine states of rubidium and operate, say, somewhere in between the D1 and D2 lines. Problem is, you have off-resonant scattering that's significant. You could work with two different species of atoms. It might be less of a problem. You could decide that rubidium isn't your best choice. Maybe you want to make a cesium BEC. The difference between a D1 and D2 is large enough there that this might actually work, but you have to have a cesium BEC. That's not exactly convenient. Okay.
Do you have to have a very different number of atoms for the probe?
Yes, you want a very small number of atoms in the ancillary system.
But even that, in that is both Fermi mixture experiment where people see a shift of the transition because of adding, like, 10%, that might also happen even if you have a small. You might screw up.
Well, that's an effect that has to do with the fact that both the fermions and the bosons see the lattice. So at least the hand-waving explanation that Esslinger came up for that was that I think it's Esslinger's data you're talking about. If there's a fermion already on a site, then when the boson goes onto that site, it sees a higher potential. So either you say it's disordered or the lattice looks deeper or shallower and you shift the transition point. Okay, if the bosons are actually completely free, then they will spend hardly any time at the minima of the lattices anyway. Although you're right, there may be an effect. Maybe this even, you know, say mediated phonons or something. I don't know. But if the density is low enough, it shouldn't be a problem. Okay. So the second idea we have is involving using this novel lattice that I very briefly alluded to. So we have the capacity to, in addition, create these sinusoidal lattices to create one that has a morphological structure. So you start with a series that looks like a sinusoid, then you take two neighboring sites and you can combine them like this. We've done this. And if you had just one atom in each of these sites and you're in the mod insulator, and you combine them, you better have two atoms on this site. If you didn't, you had something resembling temperature. So this is, I think, a very realistic idea we have of measuring temperature. What are the possible outcomes? Well, there might be, say you're at a pretty low temperature, there might be one atom on the combined site, there might be two, that's what you're looking for, or there might be three. Everything else is down in probability. So you need to be able to distinguish twos from ones and threes. And as it turns out, you can. So once you've combined them like this, if you separate them and put a tilt on or allow them to have some kind of time evolution, the structure of that time evolution depends upon the initial number of atoms. Ones, twos, or threes. We can also look, because of the on-site interaction, if you put a little tilt on like this, the collisional energy between the atoms makes the vibrational state between these two things resonant or not resonant. So you can have a number-dependent tunneling over here, then you measure the atoms on the left. We can do that measurement. So this is a way of distinguishing twos from ones and threes.
Okay.
So that experiment, something we do definitely want to do. Yes.
In practice, I mean, can you do several different measurements at different temperatures without knowing what each of these temperatures actually?
No, no. We have to prepare the system. You mean to benchmark them against one another?
Just to get a bunch of different sets of data, so transitions, at varying temperatures, even though one doesn't really know what these temperatures are.
I see. So fortunately for us, these systems, I hope I'm answering the right question here. We can prepare these systems so one after the other is pretty much the same. I mean, there's differences in number and lattice depth, but pretty much the same. So if we measure the temperature in one shot, we're pretty much assured the temperature in the next shot is not going to be too different. So that we can certainly prepare a system at a desired temperature, measure the temperature once, and then repeat the experiment and measure some other observable.
That's presumably what you would have done in all the data that you show.
I have no idea what the temperature is.
I understand that.
Okay.
But that's whatever it is, it's roughly the same temperature.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely.
But can you vary that?
I can make it higher.
A different value, even though one doesn't.
I can make it higher.
You vary it. You can make it higher, I see.
That's no problem at all.
can you like have several reasonably interesting temperatures which are somewhat different?
What I can do for you is tell you the temperature of the initial BEC that gave rise to the lattice system. And we can control that reasonably well. What I cannot do for you is tell you what temperature that corresponds to in the lattice, nor can I tell you how much entropy I've added. So I assume I'm as adiabatic as I can be, but you're adding entropy, and how much you add might depend on the temperature.
I mean, I would assume that for somewhat different temperatures, this evolution of this width versus the depth would be different, right? Just see whether it's...
I think I've gone too far. No, I didn't. Which one am I? This one? Yeah, this one would certainly be different. I think the more interesting one to look at is this one. You better see the bimodal distribution disappear. And actually, I can tell you it's easy to make it disappear. It's no problem at all. Okay. The fact of the matter is, though, this peak width isn't as sensitive as you'd like on temperature. It's pretty easy to be doing an experiment and have something go wrong and be twice TC. And this will be a little wider, but it'll still go from sharp, narrow to sharp, to fat. That doesn't change, that qualitative behavior. Okay.
So can you just put up the momentum noise correlation pictures? I just want to hear from you again, what do you really learn from these three sequence of these three pictures?
So let's look at the process data instead. The information in these data, as far as we can tell, constitutes the spatial extent of the non-insulating region. So what we're doing is we're masking out all those atoms which are superfluid, and then we're measuring the correlations in the remaining atoms. If you had a perfect mod insulator, the only information is about how big the insulating region is. Those capital N's are the only information that's in there. Okay. And then, so then you see here that the noise signal is hardly changing, then it's increasing. And there's a red dashed line. That red dashed line is me doing a mean field calculation about how big the mod insulating region is. And then multiplying by 0.45, because I don't know why it's too small. And exactly the same thing over here in the width. I'm thinking how big is the spatial extent of the system, and that corresponds to a width. That's actually why I got to doing this calculation, as I thought that, well, order T over U corrections ought to come in. And as it turns out, because you're projecting along these axes, these order corrections don't come in. Okay?
No more further questions? Then let's thank the speaker again. And I also want to